There is a reason why 40, 50, and 60 don't look the way they used to, and it's not because of feminism or better living through exercise. It's because of hair dye. In the 1950s, only 7% of American women dyed their hair. Today, there are parts of Manhattan and Los Angeles where there are no gray-haired women at all. Once, some years ago, I went to Le Cirque, a well-known New York restaurant, to a lunch in honor of a woman named Jean Harris, who had just that week been released from 12 years in prison for murdering her diet doctor boyfriend, and she was the only woman in the restaurant with gray hair. Hair dye has changed everything, but it almost never gets the credit. It's the most powerful weapon older women have against the youth culture, and because it actually succeeds at stopping the clock, at least where your hair color is concerned, it makes women open to far more drastic procedures like facelifts. I can make a case that it's at least partly responsible for the number of women entering and managing to stay in the job market in middle and late middle age, as well as for all sorts of fashion trends. For example, it's one of the reasons women don't wear hats anymore, and it's entirely the reason that everyone I know has a closet full of black clothes. Think about it. 50 years ago, women of a certain age almost never wore black. Black was for widows, specifically for Italian war widows, and even Gloria Steinem might concede that the average Italian war widow made you believe that 60 was the new 75. If you have gray hair, black makes you look not just older, but sadder. But black looks great on older women with dark hair. So great, in fact, that even younger women with dark hair now wear black. Even blondes wear black. Even women in L.A. wear black. Most everyone wears black except for anchor women, United States senators, and residents of Texas. And I feel really bad for them. I mean, black makes your life so much simpler. Everything matches black, especially black. But back to hair dye. I began having my hair dyed about 15 years ago. And for many years, I was categorized by my colorist as a single-process customer. Whatever was being done to me, which I honestly have no idea how to describe, did not involve peroxide and therefore took only 90 minutes every 6 weeks or so. Whenever I complained about how long it took, I was told that I was lucky I wasn't blonde. Where hair dye is concerned, being blonde is practically a career. Oh, the poor blondes. They were sitting there at the colorist's when I arrived, and they were still sitting there when I left. Their scalps were sectioned off and dotted with little aluminum foil packets. They had to sit under hair dryers. They complained bitterly about their dry and damaged hair and their chronic split ends. I felt superior to them in every way. For the first time in my life, it seemed there was an advantage to being a brunette. But then, about a year ago, my colorist gave me several highlights as a present. Highlights, you probably know, are little episodes of blondness that are scattered about your head. They involve peroxide. They extend the length of time involved in hair dyeing from unbearable to unendurable. As I sat in the chair, waiting for my highlights to sink in, I was bored witless. Hours passed. I couldn't imagine why I had been conned into agreeing to this free trial. I vowed that I would never, ever even be tempted to have highlights again, much less to pay money for them. They are, in addition to being time-consuming, wildly expensive, naturally. But you will probably not be surprised to hear this. Those highlights were a little like that first sip of Brandy Alexander that Lee Remick drank in Days of Wine and Roses. I emerged onto Madison Avenue with four tiny, virtually invisible, blondish streaks in my hair, and was so thrilled and overwhelmed by the change in my appearance that I honestly thought that when I came home, my husband wouldn't recognize me. As it happened, he didn't even notice I'd done anything to myself. But it didn't matter. From that moment on, I was hooked. As a result, my hair dyeing habit now takes at least 3 hours every 6 weeks or so, and because my hair colorist is, in her world, only slightly less famous than Hillary Clinton, it costs more per year than my first automobile. Let's talk about nails. I want to ask a question. When and how did it happen that you absolutely had to have a manicure? I don't begin to know the answer, but I want to leave the question out there floating around in the atmosphere as a reminder that just when you think you know exactly how many things you have to do to yourself where maintenance is concerned, another can pop up out of nowhere and take a huge bite out of your life. I spent the first 45 years of my life never thinking about my nails. Occasionally, I filed them with the one lone, wretched emery board I owned. A side note on this subject. One of the compelling mysteries of the world, right up there with the missing socks, is what happens to all the other emery boards in the box of emery boards you bought so that you would have more than just one lone, wretched emery board. Anyway, occasionally I filed my nails, put a little polish on them, and went out into the world. This process took about 3 minutes, twice a year. Just kidding, but not by much. I knew there were women who had manicures on a regular basis, but in my opinion, they were indolent women who had nothing better to do. Or they were under the mistaken impression that painted nails were glamorous. They were certainly not women who made their living at a typewriter, the machine that was the sworn enemy of long nails. And then one day, like mushrooms, a trillion nail places appeared in Manhattan. Suddenly there were more nail places than there were liquor stores or Kinko's or opticians or dry cleaners or locksmiths, and there are way more of all of those in Manhattan than you can ever understand. Sometimes it seemed there were more nail places in Manhattan than there were nails. Most of these nail places were staffed by young Korean women, all of whom could do a manicure quickly and efficiently and not eat up the clock in any way by feigning the remotest interest in their customers. And they were incredibly cheap, $8 or $10 at most for a regular manicure. Soon, everyone was getting manicures. If your nails weren't manicured as opposed to merely clean, you felt ungroomed. You felt ashamed. You felt like sitting on your hands. And so it became necessary to have manicures once a week. Which brings me, alas, to pedicures. The best thing about a pedicure is that most of the year, from September to May to be exact, no one except your loved one knows if you have had one. The second best thing about a pedicure is that while you're having your feet done, you have the use of your hands and can easily read or even talk on a cell phone. The third best thing about a pedicure is that when it's over, your feet really do look adorable. The worst thing about pedicures is that they take way too much time. And then just when you think you're done, you have to wait for your toenails to dry. It takes almost as long for your toenails to dry as it does to have a pedicure. So there you sit for what seems like eternity. And finally, you can't stand waiting one more minute. So you gently slip on your sandals and leave. And on the way home, you absolutely ruin the polish on your big toe. And since your big toe is really the only thing anyone notices as far as your feet are concerned, you might as well not have had a pedicure in the first place. Okay, now, next. Unwanted hair. I'm sorry to report that I have a mustache. The truth is, I probably always had a mustache. But for years, it was sort of dormant or incipient or threatening in the way a cloudy sky threatens to rain. On a few occasions in my younger years, it turned dark and stormy, and when it did, I dealt with it by going to the drugstore and buying a much too large jar of something called Jolene Cream Bleach. I always tried to buy a small jar of Jolene Cream Bleach, but no one stocks it, for the obvious reason that it costs less than the big jar. This trip to the store was usually followed almost immediately by the discovery of several other barely used, perfectly good, much too large jars of Jolene Cream Bleach, which turned out to have been right there all along under the bathroom sink where I had just looked for them. I swear I had and yet didn't see them. Jolene Cream Bleach turns the mustache on your upper lip to the exact color of Richard Gebhardt's hair, which is better than it's looking like Frida Kahlo's mustache, but it's still slightly hairier than you mean it to be. But then along came menopause, and with it, my mustache changed. It was no longer dormant, incipient, and threatening. It was now just plain there. Fortunately, at the time, I was going to a lovely Russian-born hairdresser named Nina on the Upper West Side of Manhattan who, as it turned out, specialized in something called threading, a fantastic and thrilling method of hair removal she had learned in Russia, and which, as far as I can tell, is the only thing the Russians managed to outdo us at in 50 years of the Cold War. Threading involves thread, garden variety sewing thread, a long strand of which is twisted and maneuvered in a sort of cat's cradle configuration so as to remove hair in a way that's quick and painful, although not, I should point out, as painful as, say, labor. The results last about a month. For a long time, threading seemed like a wonderful and not particularly burdensome addition to my maintenance regime. Nina did my hair twice a week, so it took only 5 additional minutes for her to thread my mustache, plus, of course, 10 additional minutes to thread my eyebrows. Not that I needed my eyebrows threaded, because my bangs are so long you can't even tell whether I have eyebrows, much less whether they need weeding. But as long as Nina was doing the mustache, it seemed to her, and let's face it to me, that she might as well do the eyebrows too. Having your eyebrows threaded is much more expensive and much more painful, although not, I should point out, as painful as labor. And it causes you to sneeze uncontrollably. But that's a small price to pay. In fact, the cost of threading is a small price to pay for the smooth and lovely result. Unfortunately, though, a couple of years ago, I moved away from the Upper West Side to the Upper East Side of Manhattan, taking my mustache with me, but leaving behind Nina and her compelling geographical convenience. So now I must add the travel time and cab fare to the cost of threading. On the other hand, where unwanted hair is concerned, I'm duty-bound to report that I spend considerably less time having myself waxed than I used to because, and you don't see a whole lot of this in those cheerful, idiotic books on menopause, at a certain point, you have less hair in all sorts of places you used to have quite a lot. When I was growing up, I had a friend who was a pioneer in waxing. She first had her legs waxed when she was 15, and this was in 1956, when waxing was really practically unknown. She assured me at the time that if I didn't start getting my legs waxed, if I persisted in simply shaving like all the other commoners in the world, the hair would grow in faster and faster and faster and faster, and eventually I would look like a bear. This turns out not to be true. You can shave your legs for many years, and they don't really get a whole lot hairier than when they started. And then, at a certain age, they get less hairy. My guess is that by the time I'm 80, I will be able to handle any offending hair on my legs with 2 plucks of an eyebrow tweezer. As for waxing what I like to call my bikini, it has become but a brief episode in what the fashion magazines refer to as my beauty regimen. And owing to my ability to avoid wearing a bathing suit except on rare occasions, I rarely need to do it anymore. In the old days, however, a bikini wax was not just painful. It was truly as painful as labor. I dealt with the pain by using the breathing exercises I learned in Lama's classes. I recommend them highly, although not for childbirth, for which they are virtually useless. I understand that some women have their pubic hair removed entirely, or shaped, like topiary, into triangles and hearts and the like. I am too old for this. Thank God. Speaking of the pain of labor, which I seem to be, I would like to interject a short, irrelevant note. Why do people always say you forget the pain of labor? I haven't forgotten the pain of labor. Labor hurt. It hurt a lot. The fact that I am not currently in pain and cannot simulate the pain of labor doesn't mean I don't remember it. I am currently not eating a wonderful piece of grilled chicken I once had in Asolo, Italy in 1982, but I remember it well. It was delicious. I can tell you exactly what it tasted like. And except for the time when I returned to the restaurant 6 years later and ordered it again, and it turned out amazingly to be exactly as wonderful as I remembered, I have never tasted chicken that was crisper, tastier, or juicier. The song has ended, but the melody lingers on, and that goes for the pain of labor, but not in a good way. Next category of maintenance, exercise. I would like to be in shape. I have a friend who gets up every morning at 5 a.m. and essentially does a triathlon. I'm not exaggerating. She is Iron Woman. She lifts weights. She runs marathons. She bicycles for hours. Last summer, she took swimming lessons, and within a week, she was talking about swimming around the island of Manhattan. A few summers ago, I decided to do some swimming, and within a week, I had swimmer's ear. Have you ever had it? It's torture. Water rattles around in your ear and itches so much that it wakes you up at night, and there's absolutely no way you can scratch it short of plunging your finger into your brain stem. My own theory about Van Gogh is that he cut off his ear because he'd made the mistake of taking up swimming. In any case, I would like to be in shape. I would. But every time I try to get into shape, something goes wrong and makes it impossible. Let me make this clear. Every time I get into shape, something breaks. Exercise, as you no doubt know, is a late arrival in the history of civilization. Until around 1910, people exercised all the time, but they didn't think of it as exercise. They thought of it as life itself. They had to get from one place to the other, usually on foot, and harvest the crop, and wage war, and so on. But then the automobile was invented, not to mention the Sherman tank, and that pretty much led to what we have today, a country full of under-exercised and often overweight people, and a parallel universe of over-exercised but not necessarily underweight people. I myself swing between the two universes. I spend time getting into shape, then something breaks, and then I spend time recovering and not being in shape. Then I recover, and I get into shape, then something new breaks. So far, in the breakage department, I have managed the following. I pulled my lower back doing sit-ups. I threw out my right hip on the treadmill. I got shin splints from jogging. I entirely destroyed my neck just from rolling over in bed. A few years ago, during a wild and committed period of exercise, I happened to be sent a tape of the movie Chicago, and I made the mistake of confusing it with an exercise video. It was without question the greatest exercise video I have ever worked out to. I could lift weights forever while watching it. For the first time in my exercising life, I was never bored. I could be Catherine Zeta-Jones, and then I could be Renee Zellweger. I pranced around my apartment, waving my 5-pound weights here and there and singing all that jazz. I have never been happier exercising. But after 3 weeks, I woke up one morning in horrible pain and discovered I couldn't move my arms. Millions of dollars in doctor's fees later, it turned out that I had not one, but two frozen shoulders, the result of lifting too many weights for far too long. It took 2 years for these frozen shoulders to thaw, and in the meantime, I had pretty much resigned myself to the prospect of never being able to scratch my own back or zip up a dress, not that I wear dresses, but if I did. But I am now exercising again. I have a trainer. I have my treadmill. I have my TV set over the treadmill. I exercise almost 4 hours a week, and I would rather be in Philadelphia, although not in labor. Finally, skin. In my bathroom, there are many bottles. There are also many jars. Most of these bottles and jars contain products for the skin, although none of them contain something that is called merely skin cream. Instead, they contain face cream, or hand lotion, or body lotion, or foot cream. Remember when we were young, there was only Nivea. Life was so simple. I know in my heart that all these labels on these bottles and jars are whimsical and arbitrary and designed to make vulnerable, pitiable women like me shell out astronomical sums of money for useless products. On the other hand, you will probably never see me using foot cream on my face, just in case. Here, for example, right next to the sink, is a bottle of something called Strivectin SD. For exactly 5 minutes in 2004, Strivectin SD was thought to be the fountain of youth. It instead turned out to be simply skin lotion, a bottle of which cost an arm and a leg. But meanwhile, for one brief shining moment, I believed it was the answer to everything. The woman who sold it to me at the cosmetics counter behaved as if she were slipping me a bottle of aged whiskey during Prohibition. "It just came in," she whispered. "It's down in the basement. We can't put it out on display or it will be gone in a twinkling. Only certain customers are being allowed to have it." Now the Strivectin sits on the bathroom counter, taking up space, alongside similar testaments to my gullibility, relics of the Retin-A years and the glycolic acid era and the La Prairie period. One of my good friends once gave me a tiny jar of La Mer cream, which I think cost about $100 a teaspoon. I still have it, since it is way, way too valuable to use. The point is, I have cream for my face, I have lotions for my arms and legs, I have oil for my bath, I have Vaseline for my feet. I cannot begin to tell you how much time I spend rubbing these moisturizers into myself, but I still get pimples on my face and rough patches on my arms and legs. What's more, the skin on my back is so dry that when I take off a black sweater, it looks as if it's been in a snowstorm, and the skin on my heels has the consistency of a loofah. I have no doubt omitted something where maintenance is concerned. The world of maintenance is changing every second, and I may not know about all sorts of things that women my age are up to. The other day, for instance, I had lunch with a friend who assured me that I hadn't lived until I had tried having some sort of facial that seems to include a mild form of electroshock. What I know is that I spend a huge amount of time with my finger in the dike, and that doesn't begin to include all the things I promise not to go into, the pathetic things. I have done any number of things that fall just short of plastic surgery. I even had all the fillings in my mouth replaced with white material, and I swear to God it took 6 months off my age. From time to time, my dermatologist shoots a hypodermic needle full of something called Restylane into my chin, and it sort of fills in the saggy parts. I have had Botox twice in a wrinkle in my forehead. Once I even had my lips plumped up with a fat injection, but I looked like a Ubangi, so I never did it again. But the other day, on the street, I passed a homeless woman. I have never understood the feminists who insisted they were terrified of becoming bag ladies. But as I watched this woman shuffle down the street, I finally understood at least my version of it. I don't want to be melodramatic. I am never going to become a bag lady. But I am only about 8 hours a week away from looking exactly like that woman on the street. With frizzled, flyaway gray hair I would probably have if I stopped dyeing mine. With a pot belly I would definitely develop if I ate just half of what I think about eating every day. With the dirty nails and chapped lips and mustache and bushy eyebrows that would be my destiny if I ever spent 2 weeks on a desert island. 8 hours a week and counting. By the time I reach my 70s, I'm sure it will take at least twice as long. The only consolation I have in any of this is that when I'm very old and virtually unemployable, I will at least have something to do. Assuming, of course, that I haven't spent all my money doing it. Blind as a bat. I can't read a word on the map. I know we're on Route 110 heading east because we just drove past a large sign that said so. Now we seem to be in Fort Salonga. I'm sure Fort Salonga is on the map, but I can't find my reading glasses, so I can't read the map. One of the nicest things about being able to read a map, which I used to be able to do without reading glasses, is that you're never really lost if you can find yourself on a map. But those days are over. We're lost. We hate being lost. I hate being lost. He hates being lost. And our marriage hates being lost. On the other hand, I have to admit, we're getting used to it. And because it's my fault, and not my husband's, that I can't find my reading glasses, although it's his fault, and not mine, that there's no magnifying glass in the glove compartment, I say mellow things like, well, at least we're headed in the right direction. My husband says mellow things too, like, well, we've never come this way before, so it might be interesting. And he's right. It might be interesting, except that it's very dark outside, and the only thing I can see clearly is a sign that says we're on Route 110, heading east through Fort Salonga, wherever that is. I can't read a word in the telephone book. When I was a young newspaper reporter, I always began by looking in the telephone book. You'd be amazed at how many people were right there, listed, waiting to be found. Years later, I tried to convey this to my children, but they ignored me. It drove me crazy. My children thought that calling directory assistance was free, on top of which they always pressed the number 1 to be connected for an additional charge of 35 cents. This drove me even crazier. Now that I can't read the fine print in the telephone book, I'm forced to call directory assistance. I speak to a recording. I miss my relationship with the telephone book. I miss what it stood for. Self-sufficiency. Democracy. The belief that you could find what you were looking for in a place that everyone in the world had access to. Just thinking about the telephone book makes me misty about a world where everyone, or nearly everyone, was in the book. And what's more, I could find them without the assistance of a disembodied recording that doesn't understand a word I'm saying. I can't read a word on the menu. I can't read a word in the weekly television listings. I can't read a word in the cookbook. I can't do the puzzle. I can't read a word in anything at all unless it's written in extremely large type, the larger the better. The other day on the computer, I pulled up something I wrote 3 years ago, and it was written in type so small I can't imagine how I wrote the thing in the first place. I used to write in 12-point type. Now I am up to 16 and thinking about going to 18 or even 20. I'm extremely sad about this. Mostly I'm sad about just plain reading. When I pass a bookshelf, I like to pick out a book from it and thumb through it. When I see a newspaper on the couch, I like to sit down with it. When the mail arrives, I like to rip it open. Reading is one of the main things I do. Reading is everything. Reading makes me feel I've accomplished something, learned something, become a better person. Reading makes me smarter. Reading gives me something to talk about later on. Reading is the unbelievably healthy way my attention deficit disorder medicates itself. Reading is escape, and the opposite of escape. It's a way to make contact with reality after a day of making things up, and it's a way of making contact with someone else's imagination after a day that's all too real. Reading is grist. Reading is bliss. But my ability to pick something up and read it, which has gone unchecked all my life up until now, is entirely dependent on the whereabouts of my reading glasses. I look around. Why aren't they in this room? I bought 6 pairs of them last week on sale and sprinkled them throughout my house, yet none of them is visible. Where are they? I hate that I need reading glasses. I hate that I can't read a word on the map, in the telephone book, on the menu, in the book, or anywhere else without them. And the pill bottle. I forgot to mention the pill bottle. I can't read a word on the pill bottle. Does it say take 2 every 4 hours? Or does it say take 4 every 2 hours? Does it say good until 12:08:07? Or expired, period, end of story. I have no idea what it says. And this is serious. I could die from not being able to read the print on the pill bottle. In fact, the print on the pill bottle is so small, I doubt if anyone can read it. I'm not sure I could read it even when I didn't need reading glasses. Although, who can remember? Parenting in 3 stages. Stage 1, the child is born. I want to begin by saying that when I gave birth to my children, which was not that long ago, there was almost no such thing as parenting as we know it today. There were parents, of course, and there were mothers and fathers and mothering and fathering. But the concept of parenting was in its very early stages, if it existed at all. Here's what a parent is. A parent is a person who has children. Here's what's involved in being a parent. You love your children. You hang out with them from time to time. You throw balls. You read stories. You make sure they know which utensil is the salad fork. You teach them to say please and thank you. You see that they have an occasional haircut, and you ask if they did their homework. Every so often, sentences you never expected to say because your parents said them to you fall from your lips. Sentences like, "Do you have any idea what that cost?" "Because I say so, that's why." "I said now." "Stop that this minute." "Go to your room." I don't care what Jessica's mother lets her do. "A tiara? You want a tiara?" Back in the days when there were merely parents, as opposed to people who were engaged in parenting, being a parent was fairly straightforward. You didn't need a book, and if you owned one, it was by Dr. Spock, a pediatrician, and you rarely looked at it unless your kid had a temperature of 103, or the croup, or both. You understood that your child had a personality, his very own personality. He was born with it. For a certain period, this child would live with you and your personality, and you would do your best to survive each other. "They never really change," people often said back in those days about babies. This was a somewhat mystifying concept when you first had a baby. Exactly what was it about the baby that would never change? After all, it's incredibly difficult to tell what a baby's exact personality is when it's merely a baby. I'm using the word personality in the broadest sense, the one that means the whole ball of wax. But eventually, the baby in question began to manifest its personality. And sure enough, remarkably enough, that personality never changed. For example, when the police arrived to inform you that your 8-year-old had just dropped a dozen eggs from your 5th-floor window onto West End Avenue, you couldn't help but be reminded of the 14-month-old baby he used to be, who knocked all the string beans from the high chair to the floor and thought it was a total riot. Back in those days, and once again let me stress that I am not talking about the 19th century here, it was just a few years ago, no one believed that you could turn your child into a different human being from the one he started out being. T. Barry Brazelton, the pediatrician who supplanted Spock in the 1980s, was a disciple of Piaget, and his books divided babies into three types: active, average, and quiet. He never suggested that your quiet baby would ever become an active one, or vice versa. Your baby was your baby, and if he ran you ragged, he ran you ragged. And if he lay in his crib, staring happily at his mobile, that was about what you could expect. All this changed around the time I had children. You can blame the women's movement for it. One of the bedrock tenets of the women's movement was that because so many women were entering the workforce, men and women should share in the raising of children. Thus, the gender-neutral word parenting, and the necessity of elevating child-rearing to something more than the endless hours of quantity time it actually consists of. Conversely, if you don't feel like blaming the women's movement, you can blame the backlash against the women's movement. Lots of women didn't feel like entering into the workforce or even sharing the raising of children with their husbands, but they felt guilty about this. So they were compelled to elevate full-time parenthood to a sacrament. In any event, suddenly, one day, there was this thing called parenting. Parenting was serious. Parenting was fierce. Parenting was solemn. parenting was a participle, like going and doing and crusading and worrying. It was active. It was energetic. It was unrelenting. Parenting meant playing Mozart's CDs while you were pregnant, doing without the epidural, and breastfeeding your child until it was old enough to unbutton your blouse. Parenting began with the assumption that your baby was a lump of clay that could be molded through hard work, input, and positive reinforcement into a perfect person who would someday be admitted to the college of your choice. Parenting was not simply about raising a child. It was about transforming a child, force-feeding it like a foie gras goose, altering, modifying, modulating, manipulating, smoothing out, improving. And by the way, all sorts of additional personnel were required to achieve the transformational effect that was the goal of parenting. Baby whisperers, sleep counselors, shrinks, learning therapists, family therapists, speech therapists, tutors, and if necessary, behavior-altering medication, which coincidentally or uncoincidentally was invented at almost the exact moment that parenting came into being. Parenting carried with it the implicit assumption that any time is quality time if the parent is in attendance. As a result, you were required to be in attendance at the most mundane activities, to watch, cheerlead, and if necessary, coach, even if this meant throwing your weekend away by driving 3 hours and 20 minutes in each direction so that you could sit in a dark, hot locker room next to a gym where your beloved child was going down to resounding defeat in a chess tournament you were not allowed to observe because your mere presence in the room would put unfair pressure on him or her. Parenting meant that whether or not your children understood you, your obligation was to understand them. Understanding was the key to everything. If your children believed you understood them, or at least tried to understand them, they wouldn't hate you when they became adolescents. What's more, they would grow up to be happy, well-adjusted adults who would never have to squander their money, or far more likely yours, on psychoanalysis, or whatever fashion in self-improvement had come along to take its place. Parenting used entirely different language from just plain parenthood. Language you would never, ever say in a loud voice or write in big capital letters in order to make clear that it had been uttered impulsively or in anger. So it went more or less like this. I'm sure you didn't mean to break Mommy's antique vase, sweetheart. We should talk about this. I know how frustrated and angry you must feel right now. Why don't you go to your room and take a time out and come back when you're feeling better? If you want, I'll call Jessica's mother to see what her reasoning is. If you finish your homework, we can talk about the tiara. Stage 2. The child is an adolescent. Adolescence comes as a giant shock to the modern parent, in large part because it seems so much like the adolescence you yourself went through. Your adolescent is sullen. Your adolescent is angry. Your adolescent is mean. In fact, your adolescent is mean to you. Your adolescent says words you were not allowed to say while growing up, not that you had even heard of them until you read Catcher in the Rye. Your adolescent is probably smoking marijuana, which you may have smoked too, but not until you were at least 18. Your adolescent is undoubtedly having completely inappropriate and meaningless sex, which you didn't have until you were in your 20s, if then. Your adolescent is embarrassed by you and walks 10 steps ahead of you so that no one thinks you are remotely acquainted with each other. your adolescent is ungrateful. You have a vague memory of having been accused by your parents of being ungrateful. But what did you have to be grateful for? Almost nothing. Your parents weren't into parenting. They were merely parents. At least one of them drank like a fish. Whereas you are exemplary. You've devoted years to making your children feel that you care about every single emotion they've ever felt. You've filled every waking second of their lives with cultural activities. The words, "I'm bored," have never crossed their lips because they haven't had time to be bored. Your children have had everything you could give, everything and more if you count the sneakers. You love them wildly, way more than your parents loved you. And yet, they seem to have turned out exactly the way adolescents have always turned out. Only worse. How did this happen? What did you do wrong? Furthermore, thanks to modern nutritional advances, your adolescent is large, probably larger than you. Your adolescent's weekly allowance is the size of the gross national product of Burkina Faso, a small, poverty-stricken African country neither you nor your adolescent had ever heard of until recently, when you both spent several days working on a social studies report about it. Your adolescent has changed, but not in any of the ways you'd hoped for when you set about to mold your child. And you have changed, too. You have changed from a moderately neurotic, fairly cheerful human being to an irritable, crabby, abused wreck. But not to worry. There's somewhere you can go for help. You can go to all the therapists and counselors you consulted in the years before your children became adolescents. The therapists and counselors who've put their own children through college and probably law school thanks to your ongoing reliance on them. Here's what they will say. Adolescence is for adolescents, not for parents. It was invented to help attached or overattached children to separate in preparation for the inevitable moment when they leave the nest. There are things you can do to make life easier for yourself. This advice will cost you hundreds or thousands of dollars, depending on whether you live in a major metropolitan area or a minor one. And it's completely untrue, because adolescence is for parents, not for adolescents. It was invented to help attached or overattached parents to separate in preparation for the inevitable moment when their children leave the nest. And furthermore, there is almost nothing you can do to make life easier for yourself except wait until it's over. Incidentally, there's an old joke that was probably invented by someone with adolescent children. Not that I'm good at telling jokes, and if I were, you still wouldn't know how good this joke is, because it takes quite a long time to tell it and requires one of those Yiddish accents people use when telling jokes about old rabbis. But anyway, this married couple goes to see a rabbi. "What can I do for you?" the rabbi says. "We're having a terrible problem, rabbi," the couple says. "We have 5 children and we all live in a one-room house and we're driving each other crazy." The rabbi says, "Move in a sheep." So they move a sheep into the house. A week later, they go see the rabbi and tell him that things are worse than ever, plus there's a sheep. "Move in a cow," the rabbi says. The next week, they go to complain once again because things are so much worse now that there's a cow. "Move in a horse," the rabbi says. The next week, the couple goes to see the rabbi to tell him that things are the worst they've ever been. "You're ready for the solution," the rabbi says. "Move the animals out." Stage 3. The child is gone. Oh, the drama of the empty nest. The anxiety. The apprehension. What will life be like? Will the two of you have anything to talk about once your children are gone? Will you have sex now that the presence of your children is no longer an excuse for not having sex? The day finally comes. Your child goes off to college. You wait for the melancholy. But before it strikes, before it even has time to strike, a shocking thing happens. Your child comes right back. The academic year in American colleges seems to consist of a series of short episodes of classroom attendance interrupted by long vacations. These vacations aren't called vacations. They're called breaks and reading periods. There are colleges that even have October breaks. Who ever heard of an October break? On a strictly per diem basis, your child could be staying at a nice Paris hotel for about what you're paying in boarding expenses. In any event, 4 years quickly pass in this manner. Your children go, your children come back, their tuition is raised. But eventually, college ends, and they're gone for good. The nest is actually empty. You're still a parent, but your parenting days are over. Now what? There must be something you can do. But there isn't. There is nothing you can do, trust me. If you find yourself nostalgic for the ongoing day-to-day activities required of the modern parent, there's a solution. Get a dog. I don't recommend it because dogs require tremendous commitment, but they definitely give you something to do. Plus, they're very lovable and, more important, uncritical. And they can be trained. But that's about all you can do. Meanwhile, you have an extra room. Your child's room. Do not, under any circumstances, leave your child's room as is. Your child's room is not a shrine. It's not going to the Smithsonian. Turn it into a den, a gym, a guest room, or, if you already have all three, a room for wrapping Christmas presents. Do this as soon as possible. Leaving your child's room as is may encourage your child to return. You do not want this. Meanwhile, every so often, your children come to visit. They are amazingly, completely charming people. You can't believe you're lucky enough to know them. They make you laugh. They make you proud. You love them madly. They survived you. You survived them. It crosses your mind that on some level, you spent hours and days and months and years without laying a glove on them. But don't dwell. There's no point. It's over. Except for the worrying. The worrying is forever. Moving on. In February 1980, 2 months after the birth of my second child and the simultaneous end of my marriage, I fell in love. I was looking for a place to live, and one afternoon I walked just 10 steps into an apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and my heart stood still. Head over heels, this was it. At first sight, eureka. 10 steps in, and I said, I'll take it. The apartment was huge. It was on the 5th floor of the Apthorpe, a famous stone pile on the corner of Broadway and 79th Street. The rent was $1,500 a month, which was, by Manhattan standards, practically a bargain. Trust me, it was. In addition, I had to pay the previous tenant $1,000 in key money, as it's known in New York City, for the right to move in. I didn't have $24,000. I went to a bank and borrowed the money. No one in the building could believe that I would pay so much key money for a rental apartment. It was an astronomical amount. But the apartment had beautiful rooms, most of them painted taxicab yellow, but that could easily be fixed. It had high ceilings, lots of light, two gorgeous, although non-working fireplaces, and five, count them, five bedrooms. It seemed to me that if I lived in the building for 24 years, the fee would amortize out to only $1,000 a year, a very small surcharge, only $2.74 a day, which is less than a cup of cappuccino at Starbucks. Not that there was a Starbucks then, and not that I was planning to live in the Apthorpe for 24 years. I was planning to live there forever. Till death did us part. So it would probably amortize out to even less. That's how I figured it. I should point out that I don't normally use the word amortize unless I'm trying to prove that something I can't really afford is not just a bargain, but practically free. This usually involves dividing the cost of the item I can't afford by the number of years I'm planning to use it. And if that doesn't work, by the number of days or hours or minutes, until I get to a number that is less than the cost of a cup of cappuccino. But never mind the money. This, after all, is not a story about money. It's a story about love. And all stories about love begin with a certain amount of rationalization. I had never planned to live on the Upper West Side. But after a few weeks, I couldn't imagine living anywhere else. And I began, in my manner, to make a religion out of my neighborhood. This was probably a consequence of my not having any other religion in my life, but never mind. I was a block from H&H Bagels and Zabar's. I was a half block from a subway station. There was an all-night newsstand across the street. On the next corner was La Caridad, the greatest Cuban-Chinese restaurant in the world, or so I told my friends, and I made a religion of it, too. But my true religious zeal focused on the Apthorpe itself. I honestly believed that at the lowest moment in my adult